It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. We are live at the Green Space today, our ground floor theater here at WNYC. Audience, thank you so much for turning out. It's a good thing that this wasn't scheduled for yesterday because none of you would have showed up. And listeners, when we're in the Green Space, you can watch the show as well as listen. We have live streaming video at WNYC.org right on the homepage, or if you prefer, you can use the station's Facebook page, the WNYC Facebook page. So tune in and watch, or tune in and listen. Some headlines this morning. Syria blocks chemical weapons inspectors from entering the attack town of Douma. What are they trying to hide? Trump and Hannity try to block federal court from seeing their communications with Michael Cohen. What are they trying to hide? And Trump contradicts UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on new sanctions against Russia following its complicity with Syria's likely war crime. On CBS Face the Nation, Haley said this.
Sanctions will be coming down. Secretary Mnuchin will be announcing those on Monday if he hasn't already. And they will go directly to any sort of companies that were dealing with equipment related to Assad and chemical weapons use.
But the White House did not impose those sanctions. New York Times headline, Trump scraps new sanctions against Russia, overruling advisors. And that's where we'll start in the Green Space today. With all of that and our first special guest, AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, who is here on the Green Space stage. Hi, Jonathan. Thanks so much for taking the time and welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You report on Trump and his allies hitting a new level of anxiety after the raid on Michael Cohen's office, a higher level even than over the Russia investigation?
It seems to be going that way. The people that we have spoken to, both inside and outside of the White House, believe that there's a degree of exposure here, potential exposure here, for the president, his inner circle, his adult children, who all worked at the Trump Organization, perhaps even more than the Russia probe. Remember, of course, the president has steadfastly denied any wrongdoing there, any collusion with Russia, and that, you know, here, with this raid on Michael Cohen, they feel like things could be unearthed that could be potentially very damaging. And I think it's reflective. We need to remember who Michael Cohen is. Michael Cohen is his attorney for more than a decade, but he was way more than just a lawyer. He was, as SNL put it, he was a lawyer-ish. He was far more of a fixer. He made bad stories go away. He would be the one to handle, you know, alleged payouts to Stormy Daniels and her ilk. He would be often part of the deal-making process, or at least exploring deals in sort of shadowy foreign capitals for the Trump Organization. He is someone who knows where the bodies are buried, and I think there's people in the Trump world who are nervous that those bodies could get unearthed.
And listeners, if you want to call in with any question for AP White House correspondent Jonathan Lemire, it's not every day we have a White House correspondent here in the Green Space. So listeners, audience members right here live in the Green Space, feel free to raise your hands and we'll come around with a microphone. And folks listening on the radio, as always, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. One of the headlines on one of your articles on the AP site right now, what's in those seized documents, Trump's biggest new worry? What kinds of documents are they, as far as you can report, that they seized from Michael Cohen?
Files and records and electronic devices, it's unclear. And this is sort of a lot of what happened in court yesterday, was the debate on whether or not the president and his legal team would get an early look at these. And the judge has sort of hinted that that would not be the case, that she might appoint some sort of special master who would sift through the materials first, and there are quite a bit, deciding whether or not any of the privilege would legal privilege would apply to them. The president seems obviously is trying to keep as much of that out of court as possible.
It would seem kind of nonsensical. They went to court and made a case, but were they really asking to have, the people who are being investigated, Cohen and anybody who might have had communications with, that they would have the right to decide which documents were attorney-client privileged rather than the court deciding?
Well, I think that's why the court was rather skeptical of that claim, and I don't think it's going to go that way. Certainly, though, the headlines, it was a circus yesterday at court. I wasn't myself personally there, but certainly my colleagues were. And, you know, not only did we get a Stormy Daniels cameo. Elliot Spitzer walked by at some point because every tabloid character in New York needed to be there.
Was that a coincidence? Was he on his way to his dentist, or what was it?
There are undoubtedly Elliot Spitzer, Stormy Daniels jokes to make that I will not at this time. We do believe it was a coincidence. And then, of course, we have the big reveal that Michael Cohen's mysterious third client was Sean Hannity, a moment that literally gasps came out in the courtroom when that was announced.
Right. Why did Hannity's name need to be made public as the additional person who's in the Cohen documents?
Well, part of it was to defend the idea that Michael Cohen is, in fact, a lawyer. Since in recent years, he's only had three clients. The Republican fundraiser, Mr. Broidy, I believe his name, who just himself was outed as having given a Michael Cohen helped arrange a payment to hush up a paternity case. The president himself, of course. And then he said, well, we also have this third client. And it was sort of pressed, well, you need to reveal this to prove that you are a lawyer. And if you are a lawyer, that you have the ability to claim these sort of privileges. And Cohen's representation really fought that. And then at one moment, even when the judge said, well, we need to know, said, well, we'll give it to you in a sealed envelope. And a point of professional pride, the Associated Press lawyer who was in the class in the courtroom suggested, well, wait a minute, you know, sort of petitioned that shouldn't be the case. This should be public knowledge. And the judge agreed, and it was revealed to be Mr. Hannity.
Let me ask the control room to do us a little favor. We have a clip of Sean Hannity addressing that scheduled for later in the show. Could you pull that up to right now? Let me know when it's ready, and we're going to play that to illustrate what Jonathan was just saying. But it's not a scandal for Hannity, right? As far as we know, he's allowed to consult a lawyer.
That's what he says. Yes, at this point, there's no indication that he of any wrongdoing for Sean Hannity. I mean, I think obviously eyebrows were raised in terms of his public relations is maybe not the best look, considering that Michael Cohen has a reputation for perhaps doing somewhat unsavory legal work for his clients. But yes, at this moment, there's no reason to believe that Sean Hannity has done anything wrong. Although it will say it's another illustration of just how tight the Trump network is. You know, Sean Hannity is himself not just a Trump cheerleader and many times on air, but a confidant of the president. We know they speak frequently, that he gives advice on matters, and Trump seeks out his opinion. So therefore, I guess in some ways, it's not surprising they would also share an attorney.
Here's that Hannity clip.
Michael never represented me in any matter. I never retained him in the traditional sense as retaining a lawyer. I never received an invoice from Michael. I never paid legal fees to Michael. But I have occasionally had brief discussions with him about legal questions about which I wanted his input and perspective. And I assume that those conversations were attorney-client confidential.
So did that answer help or hurt Michael Cohen's argument that he's really a lawyer?
That's a great question. Did the Cohen's team sort of wanted to use Hannity as an example to say, yes, look, great wiggly work. And Sean obviously sort of backed away from that. You know, whether what Hannity had in mind is unclear. Why is he distancing himself from Cohen? Is it because he doesn't want people to think, you simply assume that Cohen is there to try to set up a hush payment or, you know, to sort of make some negative story go away? That's something Cohen did quite a bit for the president. We know that he helped broker deals with the National Enquirer and other organizations for these catch and kills where they would, you know, buy someone's story, a salacious story, and then, you know, agree that person couldn't tell that story to someone else, but yet they would never run it. They would kill it.
But Hannity did say that nothing he dealt with Cohen about had to do with a third party, and that's right. A very general statement, third party or another party, but the suggestion there is that there wasn't a Stormy Daniels situation. There wasn't a paternity situation like there was for Elliot Broidy.
Correct. That's what he says, yes.
Well, we have a Hannity question from a caller, so let's do this now before we move on to other aspects. So, Ryan, where are you? You're in?
Colonia.
In Colonia. Hey, thanks for calling in.
Thank you. So my question was something that I saw in response to the Hannity, we'll call it a bombshell. Hannity was on air saying we should end the investigation because of this raid on Cohen's office. Is there any legal jeopardy for him espousing these statements, even though without saying, by the way, and that was my lawyer?
Well, that's a good.
It seems like there's a conflict of interest. There's at least an ethical question if not perhaps some kind of legal question. Please stop raiding my lawyer. I don't like that, and not disclosing that it was his lawyer.
Right. And Ryan, thank you. It's at least a professional question. I was thinking about this yesterday, Jonathan, with respect to me or you. If I were to go on the air and rail against the illegitimacy of a government raid on an attorney without disclosing that he was my attorney or used him for whatever, I would probably get fired.
Yeah, you wouldn't be hosting the show today.
I don't think so.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't know if there are necessarily legal implications to it, but it puts a spotlight on Fox News, certainly, it's unclear whether Hannity disclosed to them that Cohen represented him. He certainly didn't indicate that he has. So if he did, then why would the question is, why would Fox News allow him to go on these rants on air and say these things? Or if he didn't, is he now perhaps, people at Fox News are upset with him and have to question whether or not he should, suffer some sort of consequence or be spoken to about this? I mean, that's unclear. That'll be fascinating to watch in the coming days. He obviously did host his show as usual last night.
And you report that Trump is worried that Cohen might strike a deal to sing to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Now, the common line on Michael Cohen is that he would take a bullet for Donald Trump. He has said something like that in the past. But there's an alternative theory that says for all the loyalty that he has shown to Trump over the years, Trump stiffed him by not giving him a job in the White House when he got elected, which Cohen would have wanted. So faced with the choice of going to prison over whatever it is they may have on him, if he's found guilty of anything, being separated from his wife and kids behind bars, he has a family, versus cooperating with the U.S. Attorney's Office to reveal something about Trump, he will choose family and freedom over being a martyr for Donald Trump. Do you have a reason to believe that's accurate?
I think that it's a debate that Michael Cohen is going to have. He has certainly declared himself the Ray Donovan of Donald Trump's world, that the loyal fixer, that he is someone who would, as he has said more than once, take a bullet for the now president. That said, in Trump world, people around the president often find that loyalty is sort of a one-way street, and that, Mr. Cohen will have to make a decision as to whether or not he wants to, which path does he want to follow? We have seen people been swept up in the legal issues surrounding the president go one of two ways. Paul Manafort, his former campaign chairman, has held out. He's not cooperating. He's pleaded not guilty. He's fighting tooth and nail, leading to some speculation that perhaps he's hoping for a pardon down the road. On the other hand, there's former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and Manafort's deputy, Rick Gates, who both have agreed to cooperate with prosecutors, and that will, in an effort to alleviate potentially lengthy prison sentences. Gates in particular is one who has talked about, his lawyer has said, Gates is a really family man. He's petitioned to he's under home confinement right now. He's asked to be able to go on the weekends to go attend his son's Little League game. So clearly family is weighing on him. The issue is, will family have the same weight there? And we've talked to people, our reporting has talked to people who are familiar with Cohen's thinking, who suggest that, it's at least a debate that he is having, that he knows that if he does fight this, and if he ends up being incarcerated, it potentially could be a very lengthy sentence.
And there's nothing you could say at this point about what Cohen might actually have on Trump that would be so scary for Trump?
I mean, the sense of it is, no one can say definitively, but just based on Cohen's track record, what we know he did for the Trump Organization, what he's rumored to do of extracurricular activities for the Trump Organization, that perhaps at minimum there could be some business dealings, some financial issues that at the very least we can safely say prosecutors will be looking at.
Let's take another phone call. Lila in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Lila.
Hi, good morning. My question is, Michael Cohen has been waving his passport around to prove that he was never in Prague for a meeting, and it's been said that you can go from Germany to Prague without a passport, but you can't go from the United States to Germany or Europe without a passport, and I wondered if I haven't heard anybody mention that they looked at his passport to see if he was in Europe at that time.
Yeah, this is, for people who don't know this part of the story, an interesting piece of intrigue surrounding Michael Cohen. His name comes up in the infamous Steele dossier as having met with a Russian official in Prague to discuss the Trump campaign. He absolutely, flatly, staunchly, vociferously denies it. But the McClatchy News Service reported the other day that the investigators have evidence that he really was in Prague. Why does any of this matter?
Well, I mean, it would matter if it's proven that he was in Prague and talking to a Russian official during the election. That would certainly be a red flag and potentially point to the coordination between the campaign and the Russian officials that prompted that concept prompted the special counsel investigation. Yes, Cohen has repeatedly denied that he did not go to Prague. He sort of infamously tweeted a photo of just his passport cover as if that proved that he wasn't there, which led to a lot of sort of amusing takes on Twitter. But he then also showed, I believe he produced the passport, I believe to BuzzFeed, who reviewed it and said there was no stamp that he had been in the Czech Republic.
And that's to the caller's question, right? Because you can fly to somewhere else in Europe and then go to Prague without a Czech.
But there people have raised questions like, could he have a second passport? Or could he have exactly that, flown to another European country and traveled in by other means, bus, train, whatever, and crossed a border from EU to EU, where therefore you wouldn't get another stamp? That's also possible. Now, I will say, in light of the McClatchy reporting on Friday, that is a report that has not been confirmed by any other news organization, I don't believe, and Cohen has again denied it.
Stormy Daniels' lawyer was on Morning Joe today saying Cohen's lawyer, and maybe Trump's too, threw Hannity under the bus in some way to get Hannity's name revealed, that somehow they didn't have to do that, but they were protecting their own clients in some way by getting Hannity's name to that point. Do you know anything that confirms or refutes that?
I mean, that's not clear. Mr. Avenatti has done Stormy Daniels' lawyer, has done a wonderful job of generating headlines. He is, a story that we wrote on for the AP a few weeks back was the idea that he's almost dipped into the Trump playbook, where he's every day got some sort of new angle, some sort of stay tuned, we'll see, building suspense, another reveal. In fact, I believe later today, he's supposed to reveal the sketch of a person who allegedly threatened Miss Daniels in a parking lot, the incident she talked about in her 60 Minutes interview. That sketch is, I believe, coming out later this morning. And, it's unclear. It's certainly, look, by revealing Hannity's name, I don't know the legal implications necessarily of what that would mean, but at the very least, it generated a day of headlines. It's Sean Hannity who's on the cover of the Daily News and the Post this morning, not Donald Trump. So, if maybe it's a brief deflection, beyond that, it's unclear what that strategy is.
And the judge asked for documents regarding whatever business Hannity had with Michael Cohen. So, in other words, however much Hannity is downplaying his relationship with Cohen, there are some written documents. And again, that doesn't make it illegitimate. It doesn't make it a scandal. But he is downplaying the relationship. But there are written documents. Otherwise, they wouldn't be in this position, right?
Stay tuned.
You report Sarah Huckabee Sanders yesterday tried to put distance between Trump and Cohen.
Right.
That would be a first, I think, given the closeness. It's why people in the Green Space audience are laughing. All of this professed closeness between Trump and Cohen for so many years, and now she said something like, oh, well, we still have some contact with him some of the time. How did she do that?
Yeah, she's echoing a point that the president himself has suddenly begun making in recent days in the light of the Cohen raid, saying, oh, Michael is just one of my attorneys. I have lots of lawyers. And that's true. He has lots of lawyers. But Michael Cohen is a different case. I mean, this was someone who worked very closely, not just with Donald Trump at the Trump Organization, but Trump's children too, Don Jr., Eric, and Ivanka. I mean, he is someone who played a very significant role in Trump's world. And the White House's efforts to distance himself from him sound very familiar to when Sean Spicer declared that Paul Manafort was someone who worked on the campaign for a brief time, when, of course, he ran the campaign for months.
We have a Stormy Daniels question critical of her and kind of flipping the legal argument here, I think, from Gary in Queens on line two. Gary, you're on WNYC. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Brian. I knew you were going to ask me. I knew you were going to go to me with that intro. Yes, I have two questions. One is, why isn't Stormy and those two other women who approached Trump with a demand for money, the same way that Autumn Jackson approached Bill Cosby in 1997, and she was sentenced to 2 years prison for extortion. They were doing the same thing that Ms. Jackson did. Also, Sean Hannity is not a journalist. He's an editorialist. Anything he says on Fox News should not be construed as unbiased. Fox pays him to be biased. In that capacity, he has no legal obligation or ethical obligation to publicly disclose his personal friendships with conservatives any more than Chris Matthews has an obligation to disclose his personal friendships with liberals. And Michael Cohen was his personal friend.
Gary, thank you for both of those questions. I would say in the case of Hannity that for most news organizations, and Fox News will have to make their own judgment on this, but for most news organizations, even an opinion columnist or commentator would need to disclose a relationship with somebody in that particular position who was raided by the government and he's railing against the raid as being illegitimate. I would imagine if he had some kind of relationship that was professional enough that Cohen is using it to demonstrate that he's really a lawyer with legal clients, that's something that would need to be disclosed under news organization ethics, whether you're a straight reporter or a commentator. As far as Stormy Daniels, it's an interesting question, Jonathan, and I know you're not a lawyer, you're a White House correspondent for the Associated Press, but they paid her hush money. If she asked for hush money, the caller is making the case that that could be seen as her being the aggressor, and therefore it's some kind of extortion.
Right. I mean, I think that is it's a fair question to raise. I mean, it's the mechanics of how that went down, I guess, would be perhaps whether that would be considered extortion or not. I'm sure that there are allies of the president who would like to make that case. It is remarkable, at least to this point, that she has, I think, largely in the public view, remained a sympathetic character here. And I think some of that is indeed to her credit and to her attorney's credit, who I think have done a very good job in what is clearly the courtroom of public opinion, has done a very good job of sort of keeping the story going and portraying her on the right side of things.
Even if she was the aggressor in arranging the payment, there's still the fact that Trump had some kind of affair, if in fact it's true, because he still denies it, and there were some kind of legal dealings, which again doesn't mean that the Trump people broke the law in that circumstance by paying hush money.
Right. Well, the issue is they broke the law if they use campaign money for the hush money. And that's where that's sort of the overlooked point here, is that was this some sort of campaign finance violation? Did they use campaign money? Did they, or if Cohen used his own personal money, as he said, was he reimbursed in some way by the campaign or the president himself? That is the issue that's being looked at.
Right. That would be a campaign finance violation. And if Trump, I guess, lied by saying that he didn't know anything about this payment from Cohen to Daniels, when he really did know about something that was done in an illegal fashion in that it wasn't reported as a campaign expense, then he potentially is legally complicit in that.
That is the argument that Mr. Avenatti certainly makes.
Yeah. Changing topics. What happened between Trump and Nikki Haley in the last 2 days? We played the clip of her saying more sanctions would come by Monday on Russia related to chemical weapons, and Trump apparently overruled her. What happened there?
Well, I think we've heard some conflicting stories on this. There are reports that this was ready to go, that the sanctions were sort of formulated by the Treasury Department, and that indeed, as Nikki Haley said, they were set to go. The version that the Associated Press is reporting today is that a little bit different. The idea that certainly sanctions have been discussed, they are still on the table. They have not been ruled out. The White House says, though, that Ambassador Haley, which is a little bit ahead of over her skis on this, that she spoke as if it was like a certainty that they were coming, when in fact that is, you know, has still being worked out. Now, let's be clear, the president has a number of times tried to take a softer stance toward Russia than people around him, that he is, you know, refuse to personally chide Vladimir Putin about the election interference, that he has cast doubt on the claims that Russia was responsible for the election interference. He also, in their now pretty infamous phone call of a few weeks ago, you know, when he was told not to congratulate Putin for his reelection and did anyway, that he also didn't use that moment to go after Putin about this chemical attack of the former spy on British soil. And there are people in the administration, I mean, look, they've levied some pretty hard sanctions on Russia, you know, in recent weeks. There's certainly an aggressive posture among people in the, you know, in the administration, including the new National Security Advisor, John Bolton, including the Secretary of State designate, Mike Pompeo, who's going through confirmation hearings now, who have taken a tougher tact, while the president himself always seems to not do that. He says because he feels like he wants to have a better personal relationship with Vladimir Putin. He thinks that's the key to better relations between the two countries.
There's a great quote on this in the Times today from former U.S. Ambassador to Moscow, Stephen Sestanovich. He says, Trump seems to think that if he accepts what his advisors recommend on even days of the month and rejects their recommendations on odd days, the result will be a strategy. By and large, other governments don't know whether to laugh or cry at all this, but in Russia, laughter is getting the upper hand.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. There's not much ideological consistency with this president, except for with a few exceptions. And certainly right, so much of the foreign policy, and this is something that drives not just people within his own administration a little bit crazy, but certainly you know, in world capitals, the idea that he is so reactionary, that it is so just, it's about, there's very rarely a long-term plan. It is a moment-to-moment thing, often, it appears, in reaction to whatever he sees on cable news that day.
Let's take another call. Gary in Manhattan on the Upper West Side. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Good morning, everyone. There's a little background noise because I'm doing the most normal thing imaginable in Manhattan on the Upper West Side, parking my car. I wonder, as a reporter...
When does alternate side of the street expire, if that's what you're waiting for, in your neighborhood today?
I'll be done at 11, but there'll be another shift from 11 to 12:30.
Right. We once did a call-in. Maybe we should do another one, because in so many parts of the city, alternate side expires at 11 a.m. So we once did a call-in from 10:40 to 11 o'clock, just for people sitting in their cars, waiting till it's safe to get out.
Great. That would be so great.
Anyway, go ahead.
In any case, my call, I guess it's sort of a constitutional call. I consider reporters a national institution or mentioned in the Constitution. So much of what goes on passes for normal. I wonder if among reporters you feel the pressure to normalize abnormal behavior, and do you feel a constitutional duty to expose this stuff, man? I'm just amazed at how people talk about the most abnormal things as if they were normal. For instance, contradicting one's ambassador to the UN.
Gary, thank you so much. Well, that is a great question to ask a White House correspondent.
Thanks, Gary. So I think our job is to, he makes a very good point that this moment in time, whether it's not just, it's this administration, but not just this administration, this moment in time is different for people in our line of work. And that, you know, we have our obligation is to the truth. It is to report what we see and convey it as accurately as we possibly can each and every day. I mean, it's a cliche, but the Associated Press certainly does believe in the idea of being the rough draft of history, that we try to be as accurate as humanly possible each and every day. But we're also at a time where there's so much misinformation and disinformation where, you know, you can talk to, as just an example, like, You can talk to four people who are in a White House meeting and get four very different versions of what just happened. And some of that is, you know, competing agendas in a West Wing that is still filled with rivalries, perhaps not as bad as in the first few months of the administration, but, you know, still not everyone there is on the same page. That's also reflective of a president who changes his mind so frequently, who also has been known to tell, he's very big on telling the audience what it wants to hear. So if he talks to one advisor who's advocating one way, he'll agree with that advisor. And then he'll find another advisor who's advocating the opposite viewpoint, and he'll agree with that advisor. So it is certainly difficult to, at times, synthesize and figure out what is the reality. And it's also a moment where the press, we have become so polarized ourselves, and so has become such a target ourselves. And I covered the Trump campaign too, and night after night, you know, he would call, he would point to us in the back of the arena and say, "Look, there they are, the fake news." And he would encourage people to boo us, and that would happen all the time, and people would be threatening. You know, there are times where we Secret Service kind of moved us out early because they were nervous about what could happen. You know, that is certainly, you know, this does seem to be a unique time with challenges, but it's also a great responsibility. It's one that we embrace, and we're trying to do our best.
And the normalization question is such a big one for people in our line of work. I was just talking to my parents about this on the phone last night, that, you know, doing a show where we like to consider all points of view and take all serious points of view seriously, if we have the same kind of tone and the same kind of approach when the things that are at stake aren't just tax policy or even should we go to war in Syria, but democracy itself or truth itself, then it kind of normalizes something that shouldn't be accepted as normal. On the other hand, if we take a much different tone, then we risk being told that we're biased or taking the bait that you were describing that Trump, you know, throws out when he calls the media the enemy of the people at his events and other times. And so it's a really big question.
It is. And I think the best approach is simply to call it like you see it. I mean, I'm proud of the fact that I was one of the bylines on an Associated Press story near the end of the campaign when the president had an event in Washington, D.C. and finally acknowledged that Barack Obama was born in the United States. He then tried to blame Hillary Clinton for starting the birtherism movement. And then, you know, our lead was something along the lines of, you know, that we called it a racist lie. And I think that is factually true. And that's what we do. We try to just stick to the facts. And yes, and it's hard, but you're never going to please everyone. Whether it's from the left or the right, there's plenty of vitriol. We're hyper partisan. We're hyper polarized right now in the wake of the 2016 election and everything that's come since. And I could tell you that, like, if I'm, you know, appearing on MSNBC or probably from here, making this appearance here, where I'll look at my Twitter later and it's going to be just a steady stream of attacks, but hopefully it's balanced between those on the left and the right.
So let's go out on this along those lines, because today is tax day. Happy tax day, everybody, April 17th this year. I see an AP fact check on your site this morning. Trump tax form simplification claim exaggerated. What's that about?
Yes. First of all, let me just say that's one thing that the AP does, and I'm involved with some of them, others are my colleagues, that I'm glad we do, are these fact checks. It's not just for the president, although he seems to require them more than most. But, you know, trying to say, like, look, this is what a public official has said or a government institution says, you know, here's what the reality is. And this is a good example where he has, you probably remember when they were advocating the tax reform plan last winter, you know, he or Paul Ryan or Mitch McConnell would hold up a little index card and say, look, your taxes are going to be so simple you can do it on the size of a postcard. And that's simply not true. The changes, you know, for a lot of people will result in being able to do it more or less on a one-page document, but that's the 1040EZ, which a lot of people can use now. And it's certainly, if you reach past a certain income level or have other mitigating factors, it's going to require a lot more paperwork. And in fact, the president himself in recent days, until this moment, had even sort of walked away from the index card thing, which seems destined to be yet another political prop and never actual reality.
The truth is just another option. Jonathan Lemire, AP White House correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us here in the Green Space today.